Welcome to the Wheat Profit Podcast. I am your host, Agronomy Extension Specialist with Sask Wheat, Carmen Prang. August 1st, 2023 officially marks the date that Sask Wheat amalgamated with Saskatchewan Winter Cereals Development Commission. This comes after a positive consultation period with producers. Sask Wheat has assumed the mandate for winter cereals, including winter wheat, fall rye, and winter triticale. This includes the research, advocacy, market development, grower relations, and communications activities for these crops. This is a perfect time to do a mini podcast series to introduce winter cereals. We hear from the experts as they provide agronomy knowledge and the upsides and challenges to growing these crops. Today, I have with me Senior Research Scientist with Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, Dr. Brian Bears. You might recognize Brian from some of his previous work on ultra-early seeding. We do have a Wheat Profit podcast on this topic, so be sure to check it out. Brian has also worked a lot in the area of winter wheat agronomy. Thanks for chatting with us today, Brian, and sharing your knowledge of winter wheat.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on, Carmen.
So out of the three winter cereal crops under our mandate now, winter wheat is probably one of the most known and maybe is something that people have already grown on their farms or might be something that they're already considering in their rotations. So before we jump into the agronomy section, Brian, how long have you worked with winter wheat and what areas did your research focus on?
Oh, well, we would have to go way back to 2000, around that period when I had just started my own research program and we were sort of given a mandate. It was nice. It was a carte blanche kind of mandate. But the point was that still holds today is that, you know, we're off over here developing these varieties, but we really don't have the management fine-tuned to couple with the progress we're making on varieties. So Rob Graff was the winter wheat breeder doing his variety development. And I was the agronomist on the other side doing the management system work to it. So right from the beginning, we would interact real closely with producer associations. Back in the day, it was way back then, it was the Alberta Winter Wheat Producers Commission. And then it was Sask Wheat Producers Commission. So they would sort of connect us to the farmer and the field, and we would together sort of develop priorities that needed attention, questions that have gone unresolved, and so on. And so, you know, we just through iterations, as you know, these research cycles can take 3 to 5 years. And so we would just keep building on the knowledge we had developed from back then and then add to it and fine tune it. And in the meantime, Rob's developing his varieties. And so it was quite a nice hub of research there for quite a long time.
Well, that's great. We can't wait to use some of that research in our conversations today when we talk about all things winter wheat agronomy. Basically, we'll do some rapid fire agronomy questions. I'm not sure how rapid fire the answers will be, but we will see how it goes.
Well, you already know how long-winded I am.
Nope, that works great. So before we are seeding, let's talk crop rotation. So ideally, what are we planting before winter wheat to be able to get it in the ground at a good time? And what are we planting after winter wheat?
There was a long time sort of an idea that, you know, unless you were following up a crop like canola that could give you really good snow trap environments to fend off things like winter kill, there were limited options. And the fact is, we've conducted several studies now, myself and Byron Irvine. Together, those two definitively showed that, you know, there's an issue with canola anyway, and that is a lot of the yield gains from canola have come from just extending the growing season and the life cycle. And so it's just becoming in some places incompatible to get your winter wheat planted in time if you're sinking and sequencing behind canola. But luckily, we worked on a range of pre-seeding crop and stubble types from peas to lentils to faba beans and everything in between. There's a lot of options. Like surprisingly, if you think about field peas, you know, a low residue type of crop. But the reality was canola, if you think about winter wheat and the yields that come off of canola, which was kind of like your gold standard, the yields coming off of pea stubble were the same. You know, then there's questions about barley. So the problem with barley is that you've got really good results if you're in a silage situation. So like for here in this region of Southern Alberta through the livestock corridor, there is a lot of silage production in terms of barley utilization. So that works really well, actually. Outside of that, you have a lot of barley for grain, obviously. And winter wheat following up in grain is one of those situations that does not work well at all. all these other crops coming on, or traditional ones like some of your oil seeds, but your pulses like your lentils, your baba beans, your soybeans, those are all giving us pretty good results. So the idea that you have limited options when you start thinking about sequencing or trying to integrate winter wheat, you know, the excuse is I don't have any place to put it. And that's not necessarily the case.
No, that's great information. And so what are we looking at planting after winter wheat?
So at that point, once you've got your winter wheat established and you're sort of reaping the benefits from it because you've gone in and you've established your wheat phase early in the fall, you've got more time and more flexibility in the spring on how you want to integrate and plant in behind that. And so it's coming off early. Is there something that you want to do fall-wise, summer-wise, and so on? You could get really creative with your intercropping or your underseeding. But the reality is there's just a range of options that follow that wheat phase. And think of your standard like canola, wheat, peas, barley, for example, something like that. The wheat phase then is still just the wheat phase. So it's not really disrupting. I don't know that it's really facilitating a lot of advantages other than the crop that follows it is going to derive some benefit from the fact that we get really good wheat competitive control, as an example. It's off earlier. So if there's something that needs to be done, you know, mid to late summer, fall, that isn't possible with later maturing crops, and that's there as well. Typically, anything that would be following a wheat phase is fair game.
So the other thing that we might be considering other than crop rotation before we even get the crop in the ground is variety selection. And this might be a question more for the breeders or your seed reps, but what are the kind of main varieties that are on the market right now? And is there anything new on the market that farmers should consider trying?
If you think about marketing options, winter wheat is that one crop that gives you a lot because I just mentioned, you know, it comes off early. So if you wanted to, you could sell it locally and have it utilized in an array of things that are in close proximity. And now you're injecting cash flow into your operation that much earlier, regardless of the variety to a large degree. But if you know you've got an ethanol plant nearby or a feed option, you've got feed type wheats that you can grow and target there. You could sort of consider your milling type varieties. The latest, one of the really good ones right now that's really dominating is Wildfire. That's one that could potentially be a dual purpose, but it's what we see now, somewhat, I think, unique to some of these later varieties that Rob developed, where they have this ability to be adapted to a lot wider geographic region than we thought. So, you know, I think in the last two decades, if there's a wheat class that's really enjoyed a lot of new and broader range of varieties that really can check almost every single box you want out of your wheat phase, particularly winter wheat, it's what's come out of Rob's program right up until the time he retired.
So let's move right into our seeding phase, which is the next kind of thing we'd be considering. So what is the ideal planting window for winter wheat? And is there a point where you can seed too early or too late?
You know, I think when we talk about the early, right away, what comes to mind is that green bridge. So you don't want to have a continuous green plant material, or what they call a green bridge, that allows an insect pest or whatnot, or a mite, aphid, whatever you have. These types of insects are vectors for disease, and they can easily jump from something that's in the field now to, you know, a winter wheat seedling that's coming out of the ground. And so that's when you get that dynamite effect of diseases like wheat streak mosaic virus, where that wheat curl mite has jumped. You don't want to go in too early. You want to make sure you've done your pre-planning and your pre-planting practices are done, and there's been a nice break in that green bridge so that you're now ready to go. And so obviously the dates over the prairies, they change to a degree. You know, there's probably 2 weeks difference, I guess, to some degree, where the very northerly latitudes might be targeting, say, the end of August to be in, whereas down here in the banana belt of the southern prairie situations, we can go. I think our model date in Lethbridge is like, you should try and be in by September 7th. All that, though, has sort of been challenged a little bit by a seeding date study that we ran as part of one of our Growing Forward projects. Dr. Yvonne Lawley agreed to head it up for us, and I think she had a student working on it as well. But anyway, we had a range of seeding date studies coupled with some seed treatments, because some other work that we did showed quite a big benefit with those right up until November 1st. And so we know down here in Lethbridge, like, we can plant right up until the end of October. And now you're in sort of a dormant planting situation, but it does just fine most times. But surprisingly, pushing it beyond sort of recommended dates worked quite well. And to the point of that, we were actually really fortunate that we had a lot of our crop insurance colleagues on site. And so crop insurance, they were kind of hard and fast with some of their deadlines, but their response to that was like, well, we don't have any data to support seeding beyond that. And that was the issue, right? Is like guys are trying to follow up canola and they're like, well, the deadline's come and gone. But crop insurance took that data. And I know in several cases, they adjusted it accordingly, because the data was very clear that you could plant beyond those crop insurance deadlines without risk. The only other thing to be careful of on the planting side is this year be a good example where you've got a year, you know, maybe you do want to follow up on a pea field, but it was super dry and group two herbicides were put down on there. And so you've got a situation where there's been such slow metabolic activity that those herbicides aren't broken down yet. And I have seen situations where somebody's gone into pea stubble, for example, in a drought, planted a whole quarter and pretty much lost it because there was big time herbicide carryover. So you have to be cognizant of those types of threats so that it's compatible with what you're doing on the integrated pest management side and that it's compatible with the herbicide program that ran alongside managing weeds as an example.
So just to follow up, what crop stage do we need that winter wheat to be at before we hit the hard winter conditions?
I don't think that's as critically important just because some of the work that's been done is showing that it's not the end of the world. In fact, I know a farmer, you know, we've done this work on ultra early seeding systems for spring wheat. And he's saying, how about you guys add to that seeding date study and that you did with winter wheat and now do an ultra late winter wheat study? Because he's like, in my situation, this year is another example. A, it was a bit of a late harvest because we planted so late because we waited for rain with our spring crops. And then by the time those come off, it's so dry that it's like concrete. And we know it's not that bad if we plant our winter wheat into dry soil, but if we can't get in with our equipment and do a nice job of it, what's the point? And so he, a number of times, has waited well beyond even his crop insurance deadlines, I think, and has gone in like late October. And this is in Saskatchewan. And he thinks that's a practice worth exploring further. And so we have recommendations, but then we don't have necessarily all the solutions yet to that. I think that's kind of the neat thing about science is that we keep coming up with sort of these incremental changes that are possible with our agronomic system that sometimes are needed because of what's happening on the genetic side, what's happening on the environmental side, or what have you. And so I've sort of gone off on a tangent there, but that's kind of, I think, an important consideration with this is if we want acres to go up and stabilize with winter wheat, I think we need to have practices and be open to the fact that we've got producers that are challenging common perceptions and saying, look, I think this is a better way to do it. So how can we do it in a way that makes it sustainable?
Yeah, and maybe even that late seeding could be something that we do through adopt projects or even on-farm trials too, because that sounds super interesting.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I never thought of that. That's something I think that's worth exploring. And sometimes questions arise out of that. So that's why I've always liked where agronomy fits in, because you're right there shoulder to shoulder with a farmer if you're doing your job right. Sometimes you come up with the idea, but sometimes they do too. And either way is just fine as long as it leads to new knowledge that solves a problem or creates an opportunity.
So going back, you did mention a little bit on seed treatments and that there is a benefit to using them. Can you expand on that at all?
This was a really cool study that we built on some anecdotal information and also some bench lab studies out of Europe. And even the life sciences companies weren't 100% sure how this would work in especially the northern latitudes with winter wheat and knowing the level of abiotic stress that winter wheat can be exposed to. And that was the whole point here. It was, let's separate out all the active ingredients that are possible in a seed treatment from the, you know, neonic insecticides to the various different fungicides. And let's see what makes a difference and why and try and understand that. And so myself, Kelly Turkington, and Randy Kuchar got together and brainstormed a couple of experiments to come out of that. And really, to make a long story short, we dramatically changed the plant activity in such a way that it became way more resistant to abiotic stress. So leave alone your concern about biotic stress when it comes to winter wheat, a fair concern given how long it sits there in the soil in a vegetative state. It could be exposed to all kinds of biotic threats. But the reality that we learned is that it's really more about the level of abiotic stress that it experiences. If you do use a seed treatment that has both your really good tebuconazole, prothioconazole type seed fungicides, along with your neonic insecticide, it's all about how they alter the metabolic pathways in that plant to make it way more resistant to abiotic stress. And the other thing it does is partly by explanation is that it creates significantly more plants in the field. So you protect the ones that might otherwise die off. And what that gives you isn't, let's say it's not always significantly higher yield, although it usually is, but what it is in every single case is significantly higher yield stability. So that's the other key to this that we really stress in my own work is like, okay, we're working on systems and this whole genotype by environment, by management framework in order to keep improving yield productivity. But equally important, we need to have stabilized yields so that from year to year, farm to farm, we have yields that are going to be consistent.
Are you able to let us know what products that you were looking at during that study?
Yeah, no, it wasn't a secret. We were actually working with Bayer Crop Sciences because at the time they had this sustainability and action program with Ducks Unlimited. So they were sort of a behind the scenes funding partner. And so in this particular case, it was all the actives that you would find in, say, Araxyl WW or something like that. So you've got things like tebuconazole, prothioconazole, you know, imidacloprid on the stress shield side. So today, if you're wondering as a producer what that looks like, it would be like Araxyl WW or Araxyl Pro. But Araxyl Pro is just the two fungicides. You would want to go Araxyl Pro with stress shield, or another equivalent would be, I think, Cruiser Max and so on that side. But the key is always that you've got both those really good fungicides and coupled with that neonic component as well.
So just to finish off our section on seeding, what do you recommend for seeding depth and seeding rate for winter wheat?
Winter wheat is a little bit different from spring wheat in that it's got what we call a shorter coleoptile. So it would sort of use and perhaps get weakened if we went too deep. So we don't really like to see it deeper than, say, you know, you're targeting around 3/4 of an inch or so. Honestly, not a whole lot different than what you're doing with your canola, to be honest. So that's an easy one. Rates are sometimes a debate. I'll give a funny story about that. But typically, you know, if you take some of the studies we've done on spring wheat, where we see a positive and linear trend with seeding rates that go and extend into 450 seeds per square meter or 45 seeds per square foot with spring wheat, some cultivars, and you say, okay, if yield potential keeps increasing, is an adjustment to seed density necessary to exploit that? And I believe yes, for most of those new genetics. And so, you know, that sweet spot for winter wheat would be that 450. And for me on the spring wheat side would be 400. So you're kind of 40 per square foot for spring wheat, 45 per square foot with winter wheat, right? Because ultimately we don't have any control over plants. So when I hear about target plant this and that, or somebody's planting it, so many plants, it makes no sense to me because all we have control over are the number of seeds going in the ground. So once you know you've got, and you've confirmed you've got a viable seed lot with, you know, 90% plus germination, the vigor's good, you've got it treated, now it's going in the ground, you're going to be good at 45 seeds per square foot. And that's going to give you at least that minimum threshold of 20 plants per square foot. It's probably going to be closer to 25 to 30, which is even better. But people talk a lot about, well, cheat my seeding rate back because winter wheat's got high plasticity or a high tillering capacity. And that's true, it does. But that should just be left as sort of an emergency option of, if things really went bad, at least it's got the tillering capacity to come back and fill in, kind of like when you have a weak stand of canola. Like canola and winter wheat that way with plasticity, is they're quite similar. That doesn't mean we should be relying and leaning on them, because it doesn't necessarily give you the yield or the productivity. And that, well, now with that said, there's lower seeding rates that could give you the same yield in some years and environments. But again, going back to the yield stability, if you want to capture yield stability, you need the higher seed rates. And an example of that, we showed our seed treatment work, and we could show that if we had a really not so great seed lot, if we did actually put a seed treatment on it and even cut back our seeding rates, we were getting sometimes yields that were the same as your optimum seeding rate. The problem though is if you then overlaid a proxy for yield stability, that's when it falls apart. 1 year, it might do just as fine, or 2 years, but are you actually going to farm and manage your farm on the 2 out of 10 years, like I say, or are you going to try and do it for the environments that happen, say 7, 8 out of 10?
Yeah, exactly. And you never know what the weather is going to be going in. It might be dry to start off with and then change. So better to go with that higher seeding rate, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know the seed treatments aren't getting any cheaper. And I know there's some years where you won't actually see 250 versus 450 seeds per square meter, might not cover that cost. How much value are you going to put on yield stability? And the fact there's going to be that year where you needed all 45 seeds per square foot, and it really paid off because you had, you know, where we see this, or even nitrogen management, obviously, is when you have those higher productivity environments, right? So if you do get in that situation and you've cheated it, well, now you've really shot yourself in the foot because you've never got close to what you could have in terms of returns that otherwise were easily done with those other optimal management practices.
So you mentioned the ability of winter wheat to be able to tiller. And in our previous podcast with Greg Stamp on fall rye, he was mentioning that those tillers are creating a lot of the yield. Where are we getting most of the yield from winter wheat? Is it similar to spring wheat and durum with that main stem?
No. When you look at a wheat plant and models for it, at least 60% of your yield is coming from the main stem. And then that first tiller makes up the rest. And so that's the other point, is that you've got all these tillers that are just mooching off of resources that could otherwise be partitioned to that spike into the seeds of your main and tiller one. But if you cheat it back and you've got those tillers there, they're not helping your yield at all, really. And the other thing they're doing is now you've got multiple levels of development. So your uniformity has gone out the window. And that's the other nice thing about higher seeding rates, is that you then get this uniformity across the field. And so where does that come in handy? Well, it comes in handy at harvest, obviously. But even before then, your fungicide efficacy is going to go up because now your timing is far easier to figure out because everything's at the similar stage, right? Yeah, you might save a little on some input costs to begin with, but you could end up paying for it in multiple ways further down that aren't really advantageous at all.
So let's move on to fertility. So obviously fertility is very region specific, and we encourage farmers to get a soil test and work with their agronomist to see what works best for them. But are there kind of any general guidelines that you have in terms of fertility for winter wheat?
Winter wheat, it is a higher yielding plant type over most spring wheat. The other unique thing to it is that it's in a vegetative state for a lot longer, but that's actually a good thing. So there's a couple of good things that come from winter wheat. And one of them is because it's in earlier, creates a little bit bigger photosynthetic machine. Some physiologists would argue that that's not necessarily the best thing, but I think it is when you start thinking about weed competitive ability and that early shading and so on. So you've got those derivatives that are a positive, plus you've moved that critical growth period. They say that as soon as you're over 31 degrees Celsius, your flowering is going to take a severe hit because of it. Winter wheat's able to do that, and it'll respond really well to nitrogen. And so we know it could use upwards of 170 pounds of N per acre. So plan accordingly is what I would say. So if you're getting some benefit from, if you did follow up peas, you know what peas will give you in terms of a nitrogen budget that following year. So you sort of have to plan what that preceding crop stubble's given you. If it's canola, you're probably not getting much at all. Plan accordingly, because we just finished up a bunch of work on yield gaps and spring wheat. And one thing we noticed there, and our colleagues actually incidentally noticed down in Kansas, is that we're kind of cheating our nitrogen budget a little bit. That would accentuate even further in a winter wheat. So you do have to push your nitrogen. And then the next thing that follows with that is like, okay, when do I put it down? And so that is something that is always debatable and good for coffee shop talk or in the bar after the conference or whatever. And the reality is there's a lot of flexibility there. All the work that we've done on nitrogen and the way we've studied it, you could be just fine if you put it all down at planting as an example. Now, if you were in say a really high productivity environment and you wanted to maximize every single ounce of yield potential, then those split applications start to make some sense. So the more intensive, the bigger the payback, I think, when you start going in with split applications, quite honestly, and all the work that we've done over multiple years in experiments, a lot of times all banded at planting is just fine. And then there's a question of enhanced efficiency fertilizers, right? Is there a benefit there? And I think quite often we do see an advantage there. Now, is it such that we can pay for it every time? I don't think so, but there's something there, I think, that particularly if we're setting goals around reducing greenhouse gas emissions, maybe they deserve greater attention than they are. We maybe see a little bit better advantages in spring wheat when it comes to lowering greenhouse gas emissions, but we do see on the production side, the agronomic side, some benefits with them as well with winter wheat.
So whether you are split applying or you are applying all at seeding, when is winter wheat needing that nitrogen?
Yeah, it wouldn't need a lot in the fall. You know, you think about it, not a lot's happening. You put some down at fall, a percentage of that in the neighborhood of probably 30% of your budget would probably all that would be needed. The real critical thing, especially for growers that have difficulty getting on the land in the spring, is like, okay, I'm going to hold off. And then all of a sudden it's really wet and sloppy and you can't get in there. And so now your timing's all messed up and you're putting it on later than you wanted to or what have you. And that's why making sure you get a lot at planting is something that a lot of growers actually commit to, because they just don't know if they're going to get on in a timely fashion in the spring. So, you know, if you're 50 to 60% seem to be a good number, and then the balance whenever you could, if you were going to split. There's some guys that'll maybe go in another time to chase protein a little bit, or stagger that application later to try and get, if they put enough down in the fall and then they want to try and ensure protein, they might wait later in the spring, or just because they can't get on anyway, it ends up going on at that time. And then, you know, it'll first satisfy yield potential, but the later you go on, the higher the chance of making a difference for protein.
Do you have any comments if there's any benefit for obviously FOS, but sulfur or potassium for winter wheat as well?
That varies a little bit. We've done some work with potassium where we were theoretically thinking that it should work, but don't necessarily see the advantages that we think we should. I think there are some unique soils out there that might justify, you know, okay, you've obsessed about your nitrogen, but do you understand that, you know, this is a soil that could benefit from bump ups of other blends? You know, I wouldn't necessarily discount that. I would say you're throwing your money out the window if you haven't properly managed your nitrogen first. You as yourself know water and nitrogen, those are the two limiting factors for just about any type of wheat or beyond that. So get those figured out first.
So moving into in-crop, we know winter wheat is a pretty competitive crop as it's one of the first things growing in the spring, and so it can outcompete some of those early weeds. However, are there any weed issues that you've seen in winter wheat to be the big issues? And then what are our options for that in terms of herbicides?
I guess I should have backed up a little bit because of how early it gets going and its competitive nature, its ability to that plasticity and everything else. It sets itself up really well as a competitive crop with weeds in particular. A lot of times in the work that we've done and some of our other colleagues, you might not even need any herbicides in the spring. That's how competitive it is, especially if you're planting. I know some growers that used to say they would plant in, they would follow up a herbicide tolerant canola crop and not put any herbicides on their winter wheat because it was just so clean and the winter wheat's so competitive. So you're really able to be pretty frugal with your herbicide budget. One thing that we showed pretty clearly in some other ones, if you just put on a fall application of 2,4-D, say mid-October when your winter wheat's in sort of around a 2 or 3 leaf stage, and you know you got a bit of a frost-free period, like this year would be perfect for that. That's all you need, because the big thing that winter wheat can struggle with is if you have a field that's has a high abundance of winter annuals. Those are the ones that it might run into trouble with. But if you do that application of fall 2,4-D, that zaps those winter annuals. And then in the spring, you know, winter wheat's up earlier than the spring annuals anyway. If you've done things right with your management, with your nitrogen, with your seeding rates, it's going to really struggle with winter wheat if it's a spring annual. Now, the other thing that we do, especially down here in the Southern Prairies, that's been a bit of an issue would be your downy brome species and what they do. And the fact that we've got resistance in all kinds of different weeds, but some alternative measures were necessary particularly with the downy brome and Japanese brome. And so we've done work with Eric Johnson where we were looking at some of these soil residual herbicides. So like your pyroxysulfones as an example, and how we could integrate those as sort of an alternative to some of the weeds that might be rendered sort of useless at this point. And we found really good results with those, managing things like the brome species. And so if there's a producer out there that's struggling with traditional practices or herbicides in managing weeds like that, or they're struggling with winter annuals of a different species in your winter wheat crop, then consider fall applications of your soil residual herbicide before you plant your winter wheat, possibly that mid-October application of a fall 2,4-D, I would say you would probably see a lot of benefit over what you're doing right now.
So hopefully we're not dealing with too many weed issues like you mentioned, and hopefully it's being fairly competitive. In terms of insects, what are we dealing with in winter wheat?
I mean, winter wheat's kind of interesting. You know, when you think of all the three pests, the insects, the diseases, the weeds, winter wheat, because of its unique life cycle, quite often its life cycle has a lot of asynchrony to these traditional pests. So for example, take fusarium as a disease. How does it manage well with winter wheat? Well, it doesn't prefer winter wheat because winter wheat generally is flowering at the wrong time, so it can't get after it like it can a spring wheat. That's not to say you can't have fusarium in winter wheat, obviously, but it's not as simple for it to become a host to that pathogen as it is with spring wheat. On the pest side, take something like wheat stem sawfly that at least up here is synchronized ideally to a spring wheat. Now, if you had winter wheat, chances are those sawflies will have infected the neighbor spring wheat ahead of going after winter wheat, because again, you've got this asynchrony in your development. It could be too far along and not be as preferable to that female sawfly when she's out trying to pierce that stem and lay an egg in it. There were issues with things like wheat streak mosaic virus is one, was not great, but the upside to that was that in varieties as old as Radiant now, there was resistance in it to the wheat curl mite. So the wheat curl mite didn't like the morphology of certain plant type. It actually didn't like going on Radiant type wheat plants. Then because of that, it can't be a vector for the disease. And so you get better resistance to wheat streak mosaic virus. Some headway has been made. Russian wheat aphid was traditionally quite a nasty pest that would rear its head sporadically, but we've got built-in resistance to that as well. So on the breeding side, there's been some good development against pests like that. The life cycle itself lends itself really well, and then the agronomics that we put in make it that much more competitive on the weed side. So it's kind of been this multifaceted approach that between the plant itself, what the breeders have been able to do on the trait side, to what we've done on the agronomic side, managing pests in winter wheat is far less of a beast than it is in spring wheat.
Well, I think that's a pretty good sales pitch to include winter wheat in your rotation if you have a better option to deal with some of these pests like, you know, sawfly resistant weeds and FHB, all these issues that we are seeing in spring wheat and durum. So maybe moving to the last part of the season is harvest. So when is your harvest window and what challenges or advantages are you seeing during harvest?
You'll hear first-time growers you're trying to entice into growing winter wheat would be like, oh, there's no way I can harvest my peas and try and plant my winter wheat at the same time, blah, blah, blah. But the upside is like, if you did it the following year, all of a sudden it's late July, nothing else is ready. Maybe the peas are coming on, but you're probably able to get in there and get your winter wheat off and get rolling a lot earlier. So you're able to do between extending the planting window because you're planting some in the fall already, some of your acres, as opposed to jamming everything in the spring. Same thing applies to the harvest window. Now you've extended that harvest window, so you can get by with less capital cost potentially, right? What normally might take 3 combines, maybe you can do it with 2 now. Instead of 90 feet of seed drill, maybe you can get by with 60. You know what I mean? There's that to it. And so you're in there earlier, your winter wheat acres are coming off way earlier, you're injecting cash potentially into your business operation because maybe you're just selling it to the feedlot down the road or to the ethanol plant or whatever. In fact, some of it, depending on what's going on with global market prices and demand for wheat, maybe you're even selling it to a grain merchant off your combine, who knows? Like, there's not much of a downside at winter wheat harvest. It's logistically complicated to plant it because you got harvest going on. But once you get that figured out, because nobody can see the advantages when they're trying to like plant winter wheat and harvest peas or something, let's say. But the following year, if they did it, they'll be like, holy cow, this really alters the timing of things for us in a really good way.
Again, that's another great advantage to growing winter wheat. So I want to kind of continue on that theme. We've mentioned quite a few advantages already of growing winter wheat. Are there any other ones that you want to leave us with?
You know, if you go back to the yield potential, I talked a little bit about the critical growth period. In fact, we're able to shift it out, and that sort of explains our yield advantage. The other piece of that yield advantage, though, was that generally speaking, we can get an abundance of early spring moisture, right? That otherwise runs off because we don't either have spring wheat planted or it's at such an immature stage that it can't take advantage of it. I would bundle all this stuff together and call it sort of resource use efficiency, because it's not necessarily in the case of being more nitrogen use efficient, but it is definitely utilizing it better when, you know, rather than nitrogen that's available in the soil running off with water in the spring, well, now you've got a plant and a crop in there that's utilizing both the water, any nutrients that are running with that water, and that just converts to yield and to profit. You know, then you've got to start thinking about things like what's the broader advantage to the ecosystem that's around where that winter wheat's growing. And there's, you know, less runoff. I think to me, it's just a much more environmentally friendly crop that you can manage in a way to make it every bit as profitable. Now, again, there's going to be years where you don't get that early spring moisture, and that can be the killer of winter wheat right there. Like, it really needs it early on in order for it to have that big yield advantage. And if you don't have that, at a minimum, now you're dropping back to comparable yields with spring wheat, and it could get worse too. So the question then, it goes back to my little old scenario of, okay, is that a one-off, a two-off out of 10, or is it a 7-8? So what are you farming for? Are you farming for 2 years out of 10? Are you going to farm for 8 years out of 10? And where does winter wheat fit if you're managing it right? Will it take advantage of the 8 out of 10 or not? We're at a point now, quite honestly, I think, where we've got really good varieties out there. We've got a really nice management package. We could do more, obviously, but that's a different conversation. But at this point, I really think it's perception. And do you want to have a paradigm shift to possibly be even better, more climate resilient, and potentially more profitable or not? It is what it is at that point.
So despite all of these advantages that we've talked about, you know, whether it's pest management, you know, better varieties that are coming out and better management strategies, we have seen a lower adoption rate. So what do you think farmers need to be able to adopt this on their farm?
If you can exploit all the yield that you could get out of AAC wildfire, or, you know, something coming in the pipeline now like cold front, and then work in the agronomics that we've done as well, I have a hard time believing that 8 out of 10 years, you're not going to do well with it. And we talk about 20 to 25% gains over spring wheat. So to me, ideally, what I would like to see, or what I would try, is as a farmer, I've got a wheat phase in my rotation that's probably not leaving anytime soon. So instead of putting all my eggs in one basket and saying, well, it's all going to be spring wheat, maybe what I should be thinking about in terms of, you know, some of these intangibles that you talk about, where the benefits on capital costs and gains in efficiency here and there need to be considered more greatly. I can actually manage more acres if I did a split, or say I'm struggling with the acres I have right now because I can't quite get it done in a timely fashion with the equipment I have. And with interest rates, I'm sure as hell not going to go out and borrow a bunch of money and upgrade. Well, maybe the solution rests in, well, why don't you divide those acres into spring and winter wheat? Take all the good stuff old Barris has told you to do with spring wheat, and then take all the stuff he's told you to do with winter wheat. And maybe that becomes a much more viable option, and you're still able to more effectively manage the acres that you have without any extra new outlay of upgrades to your capital costs.
Well, thank you for joining us and sharing all of your knowledge on winter wheat. It has been really great, and I hope this will be a great resource for farmers moving forward. Just talk to your local agronomist and your local government extension specialist. Reach out to, like you said, Alberta Grains, Sask Wheat, and we can provide some of that information for you as well.